Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We've got a very busy show this week as we kick off talking about the Academy Awards and what to expect on Oscar night with CNN and Fandango's movie critic, Gray Drake. We then chat with Dr. Frank Farley about the cruise ship disaster and why the captain did not step up as the Costa Concordia was sinking. Also joining us is car care expert and author Pamela Oakes on how to properly maintain your car during the cold and blustery winter months. We then wrap things up with a killer remix from Beyoncé, End of Time.
Capture your need for sound.
Tis the season for award shows. Recently, the Golden Globes captured everyone's attention as the first major award show of 2012. And now we're only weeks away from the granddaddy of them all, the Academy Awards. To talk about all things glamorous and what might happen at this year's Oscars is CNN and Fandango movie critic Gray Drake. Gray, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey, Kelly, I am wearing my fancy jewelry and the first stole in celebration of this.
Excellent. You are ready to go. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about the recent Golden Globes, the winner specifically, because I think that that award show is often a very good indicator of things to come at the Oscars. So first off, how did you feel about the Descendants winning Best Motion Picture, not to mention its star George Clooney walking away with the Best Actor in a Motion Picture?
On an excitement level, it was Yawnsville, because George Clooney is basically a lock. I think that things are going to get a little difficult for him in the Oscars just because, you know, there only is a category for Best Actor, whereas he ruled the drama category, obviously. The Descendants was a fantastic movie, and I think exactly the kind of performance that gets attention of voters. So it's no surprise that the Hollywood Foreign Press, who also happens to love an actor who spends a lot of time abroad in Italy,
right? Yes.
Well, you know, it would, you know, get a little recognition there. And of course, that's all unofficial. I have no association with the Golden Globes, which will probably become obvious the longer we talk.
Fantastic. Okay, so Yawnsville overall. Do you think, though, the Descendants will do well at the Oscars?
Very much so. It was a fantastic picture that, you know, everyone is really coming back with. Just the weight of George Clooney's performance. And so he's definitely going to get nominated for actor. I believe that the picture will also be nominated for Best Picture, too. And will it win? It's a little harder in the Oscars, but man, do we just love George Clooney. That man can wear a suit, and we like having him at award shows. So he stands a very good chance.
And it's hard to think, too, that, you know, he came from being on Roseanne all those years ago.
Oh, man. You know what? If you look at the way George Clooney started out, it's really an inspiring story for everyone who is currently struggling as an actor. Because he does have, you know, a famous family, but man, was he in some horrible stuff when he started out. And he's really just soared to the stratosphere. So
now I have to ask you about the amazing Meryl Streep. I think a lot of us love her. You know, she won for Best Actress in the drama category. Is she a lock for an Oscar win, or do you actually think that Viola Davis from The Help might get recognized?
In my heart, I really hope that Viola Davis wins the Oscar. Those two women, their performances were so spectacular this year. They were really neck and neck in this race. And in my opinion, it could have gone to either one of them at the Globes. And Meryl Streep is even kind of campaigning for Viola Davis.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Because she actually was, on behalf of her, kind of talking about how fantastic her performance was. She just loves her to pieces, which I also really like to see, because Meryl Streep is one of the best performers that we have in the world today. And just the fact that she is also gracious, it just makes me love her that much more. So I think that this category was going to go to either one of them in the with the Oscar. But I'd love to see Viola Davis on that stage, because when I first saw The Help, I was so taken by her performance that that's what made it stick in my head. And apparently the voters are right there with me, because that movie came out a long time ago.
Yeah, I remember, a long time, months and months ago. And I wanted to ask you actually about that as well, Gray, because, you know, that movie kind of got panned a little bit by certain critics, I guess, in the fact that they said that it wasn't entirely, you know, historically accurate, and they'd taken some liberties, and that it was trying to balance the line between being a bit of a funny comedy and then having these serious undertones. Do you think that the Oscar voters are going to take it seriously?
I definitely believe they're going to take it seriously, regardless of what the critics said about it. I think that this is a voters' movie. When you consider the demographics of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, who are voting, you know, for the Oscars, they're older people. And I think that this is a movie that definitely speaks to older audiences. And it's really, it's a lot of the kind of young upstarts that are, you know, not really liking the racial message that it has. But it was so elegantly done that I think that appeals to the demographic of voters.
Okay. And I have to ask you, how do you feel about Octavia Spencer's Best Supporting Actress win? Because I think it was amazing myself. I'm wondering what your opinion is. And also, do you think that she is going to be the darling of this year's awards season?
Oh, my goodness gracious, I hope so. Because I thought, I mean, the only thing that took, you know, that took my mind off how great Viola Davis was is the lovely Octavia Spencer and how fantastic she was in that movie. It was just packed with awesomeness for me.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I got to see her on that stage just made my heart really glad, because Octavia has been a really interesting actress for a really long time, and she's so talented, and she's been in tons of great stuff, and she's always someone to watch, even when she was just a kind of a throwaway character getting killed by Michael Myers in a Halloween movie. She's great.
Now, is this going to elevate her? Is this going to elevate her to the next level then?
Absolutely. It's hilarious to me that this is the year that she's gotten nominated. She's won awards like Breakthrough Actor, because she's been kicking around for a long time. And it shows in her talent and her abilities, because she's just magnificent. And if she were to win Supporting Actress, which I think there is an excellent chance of, that would make my heart so glad.
Was Emma Stone, in your mind, overshadowed by these two great performances from Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer? Because I thought she did a great job in that movie as well, but it seems like she's not really getting recognized for what she pulled off in that film.
Yeah, it's a good point. I think that she's not getting overshadowed. I think that her character was not... I think that that's just her character. It's not as attention-grabbing by nature, but Emma Stone is also such a fantastic performer that she was a great foil for them. I mean, she was great support. Her performance was so confident and so strong that it allowed everyone else to kind of explore the bigger qualities of their characters.
Okay.
And so oftentimes that's the thankless role in the movie,
right.
And she got it this time, but I think she's dealing with it really well by just, you know, grinning and supporting and loving what's going on.
Joining us on the show is Gray Drake, movie critic for CNN and Fandango. Make sure to check them out, fandango.com. I have to ask you how you felt about Madonna's win for Best Original Song at the Golden Globes, because it seems such a weird choice in a way, and just speaking about her acceptance speech in general, she seems so egotistical, kept saying, my film, my film, my film, and I feel like she's losing, like, people's support a little bit.
Yeah, Madonna, boo. I am so done with the lady. I'm a lifelong fan, you know, I'll admit it, but I mean, honestly, this fake British accent was apparently just the first step to us having to listen to her prattle on about how great she is. Obviously, a woman who has been in the music industry and now the film industry, you know, for as many years as she has, is doing something right. So I won't speak ill of her on a business level. Personality-wise, I want to take her into an alley and beat the snot out of her, because although I know it's not possible because of her fantastic arms, she would kill me. The reason that particular category at the Golden Globes really upset me,
mm-hmm,
was because of the absence of a nomination for one of the songs from The Muppets.
Oh, right.
Yeah, where was that? Brett McKenzie from Flight of the Conchords did such an unbelievable job with those songs that he really deserved a nom and a win. And for Madonna to take that away from him, it didn't even exist in the first place, but it still was very, very bitter. I was just like Elton John. I didn't think she would get it.
Good.
And I was mad when she was on that stage. Worst part of the night. Boo.
Yeah, that's what I thought too, so I'm glad I'm not alone. Now, I have to ask you too about another kind of feel-good, I think, moment from the Globes, and I'm wondering if it's going to transpire over to the Oscars. The Artist, that movie. I think a lot of actual regular movie-going folk, though, have never even heard of The Artist.
You're very right. This is kind of one of those movies that the coasts love it, and everyone else is a question mark. Sometimes that happens. It's just a smaller independent film that is so darn good they know that it's not really going to make a lot of money anywhere except the coasts. And it happens a lot. And I hope that, however, because of its juggernaut tendencies in all these award ceremonies, that the release is going to keep going wider and wider. The only trick is the artist is going to tear it up at the Oscars, and a lot of the people watching won't have even had an opportunity to see it. So when it wins a ton of awards, which it shall, then they'll probably expand the release so people will be able to see it in the spring.
And I have to ask you now, you know, heading full on into these Academy Awards of 2012, again, the show happening on February 26th, what are your top Oscar predictions for this year? Are there going to be any wild things going on?
Well, the Golden Globes are the place where everybody gets really drunk and funny things happen. So the Oscars are usually pretty calm. Billy Crystal's hosting it, which is not the best choice if you want to make an awards ceremony younger.
Right.
And appeal to people that, you know, who are using Twitter and all that, the Twitter box and stuff. However, Billy Crystal's a Hollywood legend, so it's going to be fine. I think the real category for surprises this year is going to be supporting actor. There's kind of a lot of nominees that are just floating around. There's no really clear nominees in that category. So what I would love to see is perhaps Nick Nolte from a movie called A Warrior. All of these movies I highly recommend seeking out. They're fantastic. Patton Oswalt from Diablo Cody's screenplay Young Adult. And also Albert Brooks from the movie Drive, where he was nominated for a Golden Globe. He should have won it. He was mean and terrifying in that film, and he was spectacular. So I'd love to see a shakeup in that category so we can have a little excitement on Oscar night.
Do you think there's going to be any actor or actress that is going to be left out of the party that shouldn't be?
I do, unfortunately, think that Gary Oldman will not be nominated for Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. I don't think that movie really... It's not a sexy spy movie. So a lot of people didn't really pay attention, and quite frankly, I mean, some of the voters may have fallen asleep during it. It is a possibility. They just didn't know to nominate it. And Gary Oldman has somehow never been nominated for an Academy Award,
okay,
according to my research. And I desperately hope I'm wrong about that, because he is an international treasure. If anybody deserves to get an Oscar for a body of work, it's him. And I think he's going to get left in the dust again. I can't believe it.
And best director, Martin Scorsese won at the Golden Globes. Will he repeat this at the Oscars?
Oh, this is an interesting category. I think that Scorsese has won his award. And I think that Michelle, Mr. French last name, that I can never pronounce, for The Artist, will actually win the category.
Okay.
Because this... The Artist, you know, like we were saying earlier, like nobody's seen it, but that movie is spectacular. And if you have a chance to see it, you definitely should, because it's unlike anything that we've seen recently and such a nod to cinema history that I just think it's going to sweep a lot of categories. And I believe director's going to be one of them. Sorry, Scorsese, it's not your year.
And I just wanted to touch upon something you mentioned a few moments ago about Billy Crystal, again, being the host. I don't even know how many times this is. It's several that he has hosted the show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think, though, that they should have gone another route? And maybe, like, it just escapes me every single year why they don't ever ask Ellen DeGeneres.
Oh, yeah. She's a great choice. She's great at hosting award ceremonies. I think that the Oscars did something different last year in letting James Franco and Anne Hathaway host.
Right.
And that was a horrible failure.
Yes.
And I think at this point they kind of have their tail between their legs and they really just want to go with what works.
Okay.
And, you know, maybe Steve Martin was busy. So they just decided, like, just give it to Billy. It'll be great. And they know that it's a lock. Now, I think, I don't want to sound like the broken record here, but I think they missed a huge opportunity to inject an entirely new sense of life into the awards program by having the Muppets host it. Think about that. It would have been amazing. And I think it's a huge missed opportunity. So again, like, it's going to be bittersweet for me sitting there, because the whole time when Billy Crystal's talking, I'm just going to want it to be Kermit.
That is fantastic. And I have to ask you, you know, as we march into this year of 2012 and keep going forward, are there any movies, Gray, that you think that we should be paying attention to apart from award season?
Well, coming out very soon, actually, is a movie called Haywire, directed by Steven Soderbergh. It stars Gina Carano, who's an MMA fighter. And all she does in this movie is demonstrate how terrifyingly good she is at mixed martial arts. That movie's awesome and is definitely fighting away my January winter blues. Coming up this summer, we've got some really exciting pictures coming out. I'm really jazzed about The Avengers. I think that that's just a whole bunch of superhero in one movie that I can't wait to see. And then, of course, almost a year from now, the wait is going to be torture for The Hobbit.
Oh, right.
Yes, there's so much good stuff, I think, this year. And I have very high hopes. I'm very optimistic. I know everybody's optimistic the first 3 weeks of January, but I'm extra optimistic.
That's fantastic. Great. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Definitely, Kelly. Great to talk to you.
That's CNN and Fandango movie critic Gray Drake. Make sure to check her out, www.fandango.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
A horrific accident that has captured the world's attention is the sinking of the luxury cruise ship Costa Concordia off the coast of Italy. Over 4,200 people had to abandon ship, and more than 10 people died in the tragedy. Something that has stuck out like a sore thumb about the accident is that it seemed the passengers were left to fend for themselves when leaving the ship. Reports say that most of the crew seemed just as surprised and confused as the passengers, and even the captain, Francesco Schettino, abandoned the vessel before all the people were off. To help us sort through why no one on the ship seemed to step up to the plate is Dr. Frank Farley, a former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. Dr. Farley, thank you for joining us again on the Kelly Alexander Show.
You're welcome, Kelly.
Dr. Farley, if you look at most of the reports coming from passengers who were on that cruise ship as it sunk or partially sank, it was pandemonium. It seems like no one was in charge, including the captain.
That's right. And it really sticks out, and it should worry everybody. There was a total, it seems, collapse of leadership. There's pandemonium. It appears that the captain just sort of collapsed in the face of risk and uncertainty and crisis and took off, cut and ran. So, we need to learn from this.
Now, I read a transcript, actually, Frank, that I just wanted to ask you about, of the conversation between the Port Authority and the captain, and it was not pretty. You know, apparently Captain Schettino basically refused to go back on the ship and do his duty, which was to put his passengers and crew's safety before his own. Why do you think he failed so badly at that, and does that encompass everything with him sort of leaving the ship?
Well, I think it does all kind of fit the picture. What worries me is that our cruise lines running their captains through extensive psychological evaluation and workup. This is a very important position. And 4,200 lives under your care and very complex, high-tech vehicles in a very dangerous environment, the ocean. And it looks like it just kind of overwhelmed him. You know, I think the level of intensity and uncertainty, not knowing exactly what's happening, and the risk, etc., just kind of overwhelmed him, and he took off. And of course, one thing I guess that he might well have been worried about was he was in charge when the ship got that close to the rocks. And he did it apparently for no reasonable cause. I mean, there was no reason, important reason for him to be there. So he had a lot of reasons to try to get out of the picture, and it looked like that's what he tried.
And what about the crew? You know, even if the captain was a mess, don't you think that like a first officer or even a porter could have stepped up and taken charge?
Indeed. And what happened there? Was that a failure of training? Was it that there was confusing signals all the way down the line? And so people lower down didn't know what to do, and so it was every person for themselves. And of course, what you have in a situation like that is an intense environment. People are screaming. You know, one person starts to scream, other ones start to scream. There's a phenomenon we call emotional contagion. And so here you have people screaming. There's fear. There's the unknown. There's uncertainty. There's risk. People don't know exactly what to do. And in the absence of that, in the absence of clear thinking, you get this kind of a mess. People pushing each other and shoving. There are stories of adults pushing kids out of the way. And so, you know, heroism, one of our great human qualities, seemed to really be in absence.
And, you know, I was reading some more reports even today about the whole situation. I know as the weeks and months go on, I think the full story will fully develop. But right now, I think we're still only getting bits and pieces. And one of the pieces that I was reading is the fact that the captain has come up with, in my view, a cockamamie story, saying that he didn't mean to abandon the ship, that he tripped and fell into a lifeboat. And that was the end of the story. And then he was, you know, out on the sea instead of on the ship. Why come up with that? And again, I don't know for a fact that it's a lie, but it feels like it's one.
Well, he's trying to save his skin, so he had to come up with something. Maybe it's true, but I agree with you. It seems about as unlikely as anything one could imagine. So, you know, and the conversation with the Coast Guard captain, the person in charge of the Coast Guard at the port, I think that's pretty revealing. And, you know, he was talking about the Coast Guard guy wanted to get back on the boat repeatedly, and he never got back on the boat. It seems very clear to me that, you know, he abandoned ship.
And do you think then that his whole crew, like at least the officers around him, because I'm sure, you know, much of the crew was dispersed throughout the ship, but his immediate crew, which would have been the top honchos of the boat, I would think, did they just, you know, fall into his fear? And that's why they also abandoned ship and didn't sort of help out. It almost seems like it was like, you know, lemmings and follow the leader.
Well, you absolutely don't want lemming leadership, that's for sure. And I don't know. I haven't seen an interview with any of the lower people in the leadership. So I don't know that, but it would appear that the leadership was absent. So that's their job, and it very much looks like it wasn't being done. So was there panic at the highest levels? Not just in the captain, but many of the people who report to him. And what about the training? How well trained are these people? You know, are they selecting people for crisis? You know, it's they may well be selecting people for different criteria altogether. And the one thing about being on the high seas is, you know, the unimaginable can happen. It has happened many times. And you need people trained to handle risk on the spot, who can tolerate high levels of uncertainty and the unknown and take charge and can think clearly when everyone else around them is not. That's great leadership. And, you know, they need to be trained for that. And they also, I think, need to be selected for that. There are ways to select people who can tolerate that level of uncertainty and that level of risk and can get the job done. And gosh, it did look to me like it hadn't happened.
Do you think, Dr. Farley, that this is actually an industry-wide issue in the fact that, you know, we're talking about the high seas, and again, it's always a danger, but I almost think that these cruise lines, you know, they're so luxurious, I don't think many people, including the passengers themselves, realize that it's still a danger, that you're still, you know, out on open water. I don't care if the boat is, you know, 3 football fields long. And I'm almost wondering if, you know, you were talking just moments ago about selecting an appropriate captain who can handle crisis. Do you think that this captain, or maybe many captains that are on these luxury cruise ships, are lulled into a false sense of security? And maybe someone who would handle crisis that well isn't interested in captaining a luxury cruise ship.
That's a great insight, Kelly. I've had the same one myself. Probably those people who really can tolerate high levels of risk and uncertainty and take charge and get the thing done correctly, they're probably out there sailing big sailing vessels out into the ocean, where there's more room for their own skill and talents to play out. This thing, you're sitting in this in the control room, you know, you've got the con, as they call it, and it's all high tech and it's all, you know, technology and dials and digital information coming in all the time. It's like you're not even on the ocean. You're in some isolated or insulated world. So that and the false sense of security and comfort and reliability, you know, you may be, in a sense, out of touch with the dangers of the ocean and the dangers of Mother Nature. She can come back and bite all of us at different times. And, you know, I think it's possible that at least in this case, they have the wrong captain. They need somebody who's much more in tune, maybe, with nature and with how to handle crisis and so on. And, of course, they need people who don't make decisions like this one. allegedly to get the ship closer to shore so that one of the staff can wave at somebody or something. That's inane and downright dangerous. And, you know, you can never lose sight of the fact that you have thousands of lives in your care. And every one of those lives thinks that everything is secure and safe and everything is okay. And then it turns out it's not.
And Dr. Farley, if you were talking to cruise line, you know, managers and people who need to hire captains and first officers, what would you say to them? Because, you know, this catastrophe could happen again.
Yes, it could. And in all likelihood, it will at some point. I think that if they're not already doing it, they need to run their prospective captains and, as you say, first officers and second officers and third officers through extensive evaluation psychologically. This thing involved, you know, a huge amount of psychology, how to handle all of this stuff and this mess. And it's between the ears, and you need to select people who can really deal with it. And there are ways to do that. And extensive psychological workups, as we call them, or evaluations, before you ever put somebody in control of such a incredible vessel with all the responsibilities for 44,000 people.
Joining us on the program is Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. Now, Dr. Farley, I want to switch gears for a moment and actually ask you some questions about soldiers and the war, because recently, just over a month ago, it was announced that combat missions in Iraq would actually wrap up and soldiers would be returning home. Now, I wanted to ask you, in your mind, what are the key challenges these soldiers are facing as they adapt from, you know, being on duty, walking around with a firearm to, you know, walking down a suburban street with their kids?
Well, there can be lots of problems with that. If you analyze what they've been doing, they've been on the front lines. There's actually a lot of excitement potential. And if they engage, if they're combat troops and actually engaged in combat or under attack, etc., it's exceedingly exciting, challenging. They have a very significant role to play. Then suddenly they return to their home country and back to Main Street USA, and boy, it just doesn't offer what Iraq or Afghanistan offered. And so it's a kind of re-entry issue. Can they really re-enter the kind of, you know, humdrum everyday life of Main Street? And sometimes they can't. And so they don't fit in very well, some of them. And it's difficult to adapt. And picking up a kind of dull 9-to-5 job to make ends meet, for some of them, will not be very satisfying. And so if you recall the movie The Hurt Locker, which was about Iraq, and it was about a guy, his name was William James, and he was he detonated IEDs, etc., highly dangerous, high risk, high excitement, high challenge. And in the movie, which I think was pretty accurate, and fairly accurate from friends of mine who have been over there in the military, he comes back to the United States and just doesn't feel right, doesn't feel at home. Shopping in the store was one of the scenes, and it's pretty boring and dull, and he ends up, you know, re-enlisting and heading back for more of that excitement.
You know, another angle that I wanted to ask you is, do you think that a significant amount of the soldiers suffer from some level of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, as everyone seems to call it? Or do you think it's only those who sort of witnessed gruesome events?
That's hard to say. You know, I'm no expert in that particular, you know, phenomena. And I think there are some statistics on how many come back and are diagnosable as PTSD. But we can expect quite a few. And it was traumatic. And one of the issues of PTSD is memory, the memory phenomenon, getting things out of your memory, the flashbacks. And again, keep in mind that those flashbacks and memories of horror and violence and mayhem, they're coming to you when you come back home. They're coming to you in a relatively low-key world, not like the world you just came from. And so the contrast can be quite stark. So I think we can expect, you know, a fair amount of that, of PTSD. And clearly, you know, it needs to be dealt with. It's not just PTSD, of course, in combatants. I mean, Veterans Administration hospitals will be filled to overflowing with soldiers having, you know, serious physical problems. They lost limbs, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the loss of life is awful, but also there's the injuries that, for many of them, are lifelong. And if you've ever, you know, gone through one of these veterans hospitals, it is just depressing beyond measure, you know. And so many of them, it's the prospects aren't that great.
And I'm sure, you know, a lot of soldiers don't want to admit that they're struggling mentally with what they've experienced overseas. So what do you say to them to make them realize that they're not weak for asking for help?
Well, I think that what you say to them is, I guess, what you say to anybody who needs psychological help, which is most people have someone, a loved one or one close to them and so on, who has needed psychological help. And it's part of, you know, the new world where we have such professionals. We have psychologists and psychiatrists and social workers and counselors. And there are thousands of them available. And there's no stigma, you know, none attached to it, because, you know, you've put your life on the line, and to many people, you're a hero. And so don't worry about what people might think about whether you're going to go see a psychologist. It's, you're not alone. There are hundreds of thousands who never actually experienced the horror and the stress that you've experienced who are seeing psychologists. So I think one important point is to keep it in perspective and balance and realize you're not alone.
In your experience living in the U.S., Dr. Farley, do you believe that the American military has done enough to support the soldiers now that they are coming back and are experiencing some mental anguish? Like, is there enough help for them to get through this?
I don't know that for sure, but I think there is a lot of help. I certainly, see a lot of help in the VA hospitals. The country is studded with VA hospitals from sea to shining sea, and so there is a lot of help. Whether it's enough, I can't answer that until, you know, we see more of the return of the soldiers. And, you know, as Afghanistan winds down, there'll be more from there. You know, I think I could answer that question much better, you know, in 6 months when we see how the ones coming back from Iraq and who are back, how they're fitting in, what kind of service they're getting through the government and through the Pentagon, and I think I might be better able to comment on it at that time.
In general, you know, this also has to be a challenging time for family members as well when you're receiving the soldier back and you know, maybe they're not such or in such a great shape mentally. Is there something that the family can do to help make the situation easier for the soldier as well as for themselves? Because they're also going to go through a change having this person back who might not be the same as when they left.
Yeah, four-letter word, love. Love solves a lot of problems in this life, and we need a lot more than we have right now. And just unconditional love, unconditional positive regard, and unconditional help, and respect, and understanding, all of those things are what is needed. And I can't think really of much more than that. Support and, you know, understanding that they've been through hell and more than most people. And so they have experiences that many family members have not had. And so therefore, pay attention, give love, give support. Can't do better than that.
Dr. Farley, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's Dr. Frank Farley again, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
In many parts of the world right now, it's the dead of winter. It's cold, it's blustery, and a lot of times you don't feel like hanging around outside very much. Well, something that does have to hang around outside in this cold and sometimes very disagreeable weather is your car. Your mode of transportation to get you around town. And sometimes we don't properly maintain our cars in this kind of inclement weather. So to help us get on the right path is car care expert and author of the book, Car Care for the Clueless, Pamela Oakes. Pam, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Why, thank you.
Now, before we get into the nitty-gritty, I guess, of taking care of our cars during the winter months, I have to ask you, how did you actually get into the car business? Was it something that you were into even as a child?
As a matter of fact, yes. I'm a fourth-generation automotive technician. My great-grandfather and my father and my grandfather. In fact, my father and I worked together for quite a few years, which was nice. I just love cars.
That's fantastic. So, you know, I think a lot of people love their cars, but don't have the background that you do. So, and I think we take it for granted sometimes that it's just supposed to start and work perfectly, you know, in the winter. But, you know, I'm assuming that's not the case. We do have a responsibility to maintain things. I guess what's the most important item to make sure that we get done as we march into the winter?
Well, everybody by now should have had the antifreeze checked. And, you know, even though it is very, very cold out there, and the last thing we want to do is get out of our comfort zone of our heater and our furnace at home and go out and check the fluid levels and tire condition on the car. We need to do this because we don't want to make a stop on the side of the road because our car is broken down.
And is this something that we should do by ourselves, Pam, or should we actually get, you know, someone like yourself to check it? Should we be going to a garage?
Yes, you really should. And the reason why is because these aren't the cars of yesteryear. These are very, very, very precise machines. And being so, there are different fluids for different vehicles. I'll give you a horror story. We had a customer who has their car down here during the summer months, and they had a neighbor who thought he was going to help him out and check the fluid levels and top it off. Well, unfortunately, he topped off the antifreeze with the wrong thing. And that was a very expensive lesson, not only for the neighbor, but for the car owner, because it turned into like a gel. You couldn't drive the car. And that all had to be flushed repeatedly until we got that all out of there. You see, each vehicle takes different fluid types. Your ASC automotive technician is going to know what fluid types your vehicle takes, and they're going to top it off properly. So that's your best bet. Doing this should be a free service. There should be no charge for this. If there is, you need to find another shop. First of all, you need to have developed a relationship with a dealership or an ASC Blue Seal shop, an ASC certified technician who works on your vehicle, and feel comfortable with that person. They're going to know your car. They're going to know you. And repair your car properly and do your maintenance when you're supposed to.
Pam, for people who don't know, you know, I think a lot of people know, ooh, I need to get my oil checked. I need to get my antifreeze checked. How many, I guess, fluids are there to really check in a car?
Well, you have your antifreeze, and you have your brake, and you have your transmission, you have your differential, you have your power steering in some cases. Some of them are electric now. Of course, the antifreeze, I'm trying to think here.
So there's a fair amount that you need to be having looked at.
Yeah.
And so if we move away from the fluids for just a second and talk about the battery, do we need to do anything special, you know, with the battery for the colder months?
Anytime, a battery should be free of acid buildup on the terminal ends. If you see a battery that has dirt on it, or you see it has that white crusty, that acid buildup, this is not a good thing to have on it. This is actually going to take months away from the longevity of the battery. You need to have this addressed. Again, when your ASC certified technician tops off your fluid levels, puts air in your tires, they'll be looking at this as well. A good rule of thumb is have this checked once a month and choose a day. Say like your birthday was on the 20th. So the 20th of each month, you go in and you just have your technician take 5-10 minutes tops. I mean, it's really quick, something you don't even need an appointment for, have them check it over, and they'll be able to tell you at that point if you need to have any service done on your battery to remove that buildup, or in case it collected quickly, if you should have your battery checked.
When it comes to cars and newer cars, in your expertise, Pam, do all cars at some point, if they're on the road for longer than 8 or 10 years, will they need a new battery at some point? Because that's something I've always wondered about.
Oh, sure. And, you know, it all has to do with the type of battery that's in the vehicle. And there's different grades of cars, different grades of tires, different grades. You fill in the blank. There's always good, better, and best, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you have the best battery in there, it's going to last the longest, especially when you have somebody looking over your shoulder, checking it out every month. If you have a good one in there, you're going to be replacing it a lot sooner than you would if you had the best battery for the car. And, you know, even though it's a few dollars more, that you go with the best. Take the few dollars and put the proper thing in your car. Don't go cheap. Don't go cheap with your car. It's just going to give you problems later on. And basically, you're going to be paying for it in the long run.
And if we move back to fluids for a second, because I think something that is always, or maybe one of the only things on a person's mind when it comes to their car, because again, a lot of people, I think, just don't even understand what they're operating. You know, they just expect it to run. Does the oil need to be changed more often in the winter? Should you be in a habit, you know, throughout the year?
That's a good question. Let me explain how this works. Most manufacturers, there's two levels. You're either a severe duty driver or you're a normal driver. And this is going to be determined between the conversation you have between yourself and your automotive technician. For an example, say you do a lot of stop and go traffic, you're in temperatures below 32, you drive your vehicle less than 16 kilometers in one direction, and you have, you go up some hills, you know, there's little mini mountains, that may be in the severe duty category if you do this on a daily basis. Then you would have a normal driver that they may be retired and they go to the library, which is not too far down the road, and go to the grocery store once a week, maybe go visit a friend or relative 20, 30 kilometers away. They would be considered maybe a normal driver, because they're not out in the below 32 temperature every day, and they're not out in above 90 degree temperature every day, and they're not doing any mountainous terrain or dusty, muddy roads. There's a whole criteria, depending upon manufacturer, whether you fall into a severe duty or a normal duty driver. And this is extremely important, because if you find your niche where you belong, your car, because you're going to maintain it as such, is going to last 10 times longer. And that's what it's all about, keeping money in your pocket.
Joining us on the show is Pam Oakes, car care expert, author of the book Car Care for the Clueless. Make sure to check her out, carcareforthecluelessness.com. I wanted to ask you about fuel, Pam, because I know certain vehicles, depending on I guess what grade they are, if they're a cheaper model or a more expensive model, you know, even during the year, they're supposed to have be putting in the super. Does it matter in the winter, or should even, let's say, a more economical car, is it better in the winter, especially if you are sitting in colder temperatures? Should you be paying more and putting in the quote unquote better fuel?
Well, you know, you were looking at, you know, the octane levels of, we'll just use the regular, medium, and premium grade, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's not really like that. What it is more so for you to get your optimum fuel economy and optimum miles per gallon is the grade of fuel. A handful of manufacturers got together with the petroleum companies and they said, this is the formula that we need for our vehicles run peak performance and peak MPG. And those auto manufacturers were Audi, BMW, General Motors, Toyota, Honda, and VW. And a handful came back, and they says, you know what? We can do this. That's the type of fuel you put in. It doesn't matter, well, you go off of what your vehicle requires, if it's premium or if it's the lower grade. You go off of that, but you need to put this top-tier fuel in. And there's a list of top-tier fuel facilities for the U.S., and there's a list for Canada. For example, Sunoco Canada is considered a top-tier fuel distributor, while Sunoco U.S. is not.
Wow.
So you need, yeah, so you need to make sure with this list.
And where would you get this list, Pam?
Again, with your ASC Blue Seal shop, your ASC certified technician, your dealership, this list is available. It's top-tier fuel. Another thing that you need to do, too, is to help you not only with keeping the fuel pump cool, even though it's cold outside, but especially during the summer months when it warms up, you need to keep your fuel above quarter tank. Quarter tank's your new empty. You want to keep it above quarter tank. Once it goes below quarter tank, it actually goes into like a little mini diagnostic mode for us, and you don't get your optimum fuel pump. You actually, it tanks. It's no pun intended. It actually tanks. Your fuel economy just goes right down. And it takes another quarter to another half a tank for it to start to go back up after the diagnostic mode's out of it. And you're just in this vicious cycle. So you need to keep it above quarter tank. Plus, you know, you don't realize, what if you had an emergency? You had a family emergency? You have it on empty? You thought you had a family emergency now? Plus, coupled with no transportation because you're out of gas, it's just not good all the way around to keep the car below quarter tank.
And I wanted to ask you about that as well, because I've heard since I was a little kid, when it comes to the winter, especially, you know, up here where I'm living in Montreal, it was always, you know, make sure you keep it above a quarter tank because the gas tank can freeze. Is that still the case, or that doesn't even have relevance anymore?
Well, again, depending upon, they put additives in there for the winter automatically.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Depending upon if you're, not all of them do though, depending upon the station that you're going to, if they do or not, that's another thing that you need to find out. Because, you know, I don't care how much fuel, if it gets cold enough, yeah, you're going to have some freezing issues, especially in the fuel lines itself, and you don't want that. You know, sometimes that if the stations that you are going to, hopefully it's a top-tier fuel that now that I've told you about this, but if they're not putting that additive that that keeps it from freezing, then you're going to need to take the initiative to do this. Because remember, just this little ounce of prevention is going to help you maintain your car. It's going to have less trips to the auto repair center because you're just taking 5 or 10 minutes out of your time and doing a little prevention.
And if we shake things up a little bit and speak about windshield wipers, I think a lot of people take those for granted as well. Is there some sort of maintenance thing for that where, you know, every second winter or every winter you're making sure that you've changed your windshield wipers? Because I know, especially if you are in a climate where there's snowstorms and you're trying to drive through this, if your windshield wipers are not working, you are in big trouble.
That's right. It doesn't matter, you know, if you're up north or if you're where I'm at, if you have the torrential rains that we have here, you have to have safety first. And wiper blades, that's a huge safety item. Now, first of all, those ice scrapers, they're there to get the ice off the windshield. And they also have covers for the windshield and so on and so forth. You know, you need to make sure where that blade goes across that there's no ice. Because once you sit there and you go back and forth across that blade with that ice, it's going to put these little micro tears in that blade. And that's going to hamper your vision. Also, you got to remember that every time you get your oil change, that technician who's changing your oil, he better be looking at those wiper blades. Look for little tears, little rips, you know, where it had, at one point or another, had to go across the icy windshield where it gets these little micro tears. You can see it. You can see how it gets sprayed on there. You can look yourself, but this should be checked every single time you get your oil changed, your wiper blades. Extremely important. Big, big safety feature. You can help in between by keeping these clean by getting like a 409 or a Fantastic or a Simple Green and some white paper towels. You just spray it on the paper towels and run it across the blade where it touches the windshield, not on the windshield, but where it goes. You know what I'm talking about,
mm-hmm,
where the blade
yeah.
makes contact?
Yeah.
And you would not believe the road dirt and salt you will get off of that. And that's just going to keep your blade looking like new longer.
That's excellent. And actually, speaking of the salt, I want to get to a question with regards to that in a second. But a final question about wipers, I guess hand in hand with that is the windshield washer fluid. And I know that everyone claims that, you know, this one goes to minus 35 or minus 40 or whatever. How important is it to get the right windshield wiper fluid?
Let me tell you, you can rely upon your ASC certified technician or your Blue Seal shop or dealership, or a lot of the auto parts stores, they will have the antifreeze for the washer. Now, this is not something that you pour into your coolant system. This is something strictly for your windshield washer, right to the bottle, right where the water goes.
Okay.
And you need to read the label very, very carefully. And it does work. And the other, you know, a big thing that people don't realize that, you know, that water freezes too. And when that freezes, it can stress out and crack or actually put a hole in an older model vehicle's washer bottle. And, you know, that's something you have to go back to the dealer for. It's
wow.
expensive.
Another
so something
cost.
Something that you'd pay for $5 for a quart bottle, like you would see with the oil quart bottle, you know?
Mm-hmm.
One of those bottles that will last you a season or two for $5 or $6 versus buying a whole assembly for your washer for $45 to $65.
So it's,
again, an ounce of prevention.
Right. And something now, again, we were speaking about salt briefly before. Depending on where you live, you know, it's mucky, it's salty, if that's what your town or city is using to keep the roads clean. How important is it for you to keep your car washed in the winter? Because I'm assuming the chassis can get damaged if you let it go for a long time.
You would not believe the amount of salt, of road salt, that will get up in these crevices of the vehicle underneath. We'll do fuel pumps, and you'll drop the fuel tanks, and you'll see the salt residue come down. Now, a lot of the fuel tanks nowadays, they're plastic. But before that, salt would eat right into there. Unfortunately, the devices holding up these plastic tanks are metal, and the salt packs in there, and it does eat away at that. So it's not like you can say, oh, it's all plastic underneath there, I don't have to worry. Wrong. You need to keep that clean. You need to keep your car clean anyway because, you know, you'll get it up in the wheel wells and they'll start to rust and so on and so forth. You don't want any of that. Anytime you can prevent this, do it. Just even for the resale value on the vehicle by keeping the vehicle nice and salt-free. You know, it's a little extra work, but you're going to make it in the long run with the money you are going to make off the resale of your car and the money you're going to make by not having to do all this extra maintenance because you didn't keep it clean.
Perfect.
When that salt gets in the brake components and the front end parts and all that, and it rots it out. And you're spending money for brakes and front end parts when you didn't have to do it if you took a little extra time and cleaned it.
Pam, thank you so much for all of your wonderful advice. I know it's really made a lot of sense to me, so thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
That's Pam Oakes, car care expert and author of the book, Car Care for the Clueless. Make sure to check her out, carcareforthecluelesss.com.
Bring on the remix.
Beyoncé with End of Time, the Cutmore radio edit on The Kelly Alexander Show. Well, I can't believe another 60 minutes has come and gone. A big thank you going out to our guest, Gray Drake of CNN and Fandango, also Dr. Frank Farley and Pamela Oakes. It was a lot of fun to have them on the show this week. Now, next week, make sure you are listening because we're going to have a lot of fun speaking with celebrity blogger Mark Andrew on what it takes to report on all things Hollywood. Now, as per usual, I want to leave you with your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time from Edward Gibbon. Never make the mistake of arguing with people for whose opinions you have no respect. There you go. Any comments or questions, as usual, I expect them in my inbox, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have an awesome week. You and I will chat soon.